We go. Thanks to Ken, my only donor. Jenny, you called just at the beginning of the last or the end of the last show, so I can't claim her this time. And one of my other regular donors has, but we need some new donors too. So call in on the labor hour if you maybe you got a leaflet in the crowd yesterday at the labor rally and didn't know there was a labor show. Just like I didn't know there was a Facebook Illinois World Labor, Illinois Labor Hour. Illinois World Labor Hour. Just start with Illinois World. When you get to the L, it'll suggest it, I'm sure. A lot of things to hate about Facebook, but there it is. It's time to go. Please help support. Maybe you want to come down and have a word. I think I'm going to do the video testimonial thing this afternoon at the Corkscrew and Bouvon's. And then maybe try to record a little bit of the Trad Jazz group if they're into it, who are holding forth. Maybe I'll hang around here a little while. I don't know. Do some phone work. 359-9338. Opinions are those of the speakers.
Down at the local mill, work dried up, not a mill is ill. I can't pay my bills, the evil man is at my door. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. Well, I had me a wife, kids, a car and a boat. Things got bad, now the boat won't. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working, we're not a working, we're just not working anymore. They used to call us working class.
Hello, folks. Welcome to the April 17th, 2000. This is April 21st, 2012 edition of the Illinois World Laborer Hour, brought to you over the air on WEFT Champaign 90.1 Radio and also streamed worldwide at weft.org. The views and opinions expressed during this hour of broadcasting are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WEFT's management, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Well, now Tom's not here to read you the underwriting stuff, so I'm going to fake it here. I'll get the book out here. Paul, I think he wanted to say a few words more about pensions, and so I'll just jump into one of my news stories here because this deals with a similar issue.
Compare and contrast?
Yeah, it's the Rhode Island pension cuts. And it says here, if you thought of retiring, this is a story out of Labor Notes from the 19th here. It says, if you thought of retiring would help you avoid the ruination of living standards brought on by the economic crisis, Rhode Island's pension overhaul just proved you wrong. The changes to the pension system passed last November affect every public employee, current, retired, or prospective. The retirement age rose from 62 to 67 for new hires and somewhere in between for current employees. And the overhaul moves all public employees into a hybrid system, combining a defined benefit plan with a 401k-style plan, thus shifting risk for bad investments onto the workers. And it freezes cost of living adjustments for all retirees and retirees to be for 19 years, sending their standard of living tumbling. It says here the drama began in the spring of 2011 when newly elected state treasurer Gina Raimondo, a Democrat, and Governor Lincoln Chafee, an independent, began focusing on the state's unfunded pension liability and the looming crisis it represented. Both politicians had been enthusiastically supported by the labor movement, partially on the basis that they would not touch pensions. But now they argued that the state had on hand only about half the money it would need to pay pensions for state workers and teachers over the coming decades. The amount that the state owed but didn't have was the unfunded liability, and to make the fund stable, Raimondo and Chafee argued it had to be funded at a level closer to 80%. That's the green level that private sector pensions need to reach under the Federal Pension Protection Act. But that rule doesn't have to apply to governments. When a corporation is bankrupt, retirees run the risk of pension funds will disappear with the company. Thus, workers have to seek to have much lower unfunded liabilities. But when a government goes bankrupt, it does not disappear. Even its pension funds shrink. While Rhode Island teachers had always paid into the fund at rates of 9.5% of income and state workers at 8.75%. The same was not true of the state. Rhode Island had raided the fund in the 1990s and never made up the difference. Further problems came with Republican Governor Donald Carcieri in the 2000s. He cut state agency staffing levels and forced state workers into retirement early, thus reducing the base workers paid into the fund. And the real tipping point came in April of 2011 when the State Retirement Board voted to lower the projected rate of return on investment from 8.25% to 7.5%. By one change in accounting, the board suddenly increased the unfunded liability by $1.4 million and doubled the burden on state agencies and local school districts. Said pension policy analyst Tom Seguros, it's a triumph of the technocrats who make tremendously value-laden judgments and disguise it as technical details. So now the inevitable move to cut benefits sped forward in August when the city of Central Falls went bankrupt and they saw their pensions cut in half. So that's what's going on in Rhode Island. And Paul had some information about what was going on also here in Illinois in its pension funds.
Well, I haven't digested at all of the what's being called Quinn's pension reform, but I did watch Illinois lawmakers last night. I partied early and went home and got political, I guess, and saw that there is now a woman Democrat from Northbrook, which I think of as real gray cloth Republican, but she was talking like a Republican. She was going, saying, well, the primary problem with the pension fund is this cost of living adjustment. So they're talking about doing something, and I think they're trying to test the Constitution of the state of Illinois, see whether they can do that retroactively to people who are already on their pensions and their terms, which would include me. So I guess this is a little tendentious on my part. But the whole thing is bloody outrageous and needs to be examined more.
Of course,
the Sun-Times is already reviewing that the pensions reform will defuse the time bomb. Now, there are other things to defuse the time bomb is actually have corporate tax reform and actually collect some, as opposed to subsidizing the Board of Trade.
Well, as it says here in Rhode Island, the workers paid their fair share along the way. It was the state that didn't pay into it.
Wasn't matching. That's kind of that's what we have, too.
Exactly, here in Illinois.
But we don't have a spending problem. We don't have a spending problem. We have a lack of revenue.
Revenue problem?
Yeah.
That's heretical, but it's so basic.
It's Illinois. It's already one of the. It's like always in the worst five states for regressive. Yeah, tax fairness, and that's why we have problems with the spending too.
Yeah,
You know, it's just disgusting. And look right now, both the entire state government controlled by Democrats.
Right,
and what have they done? Oh, they've made it illegal to have chimpanzees as pets.
We have things like that.
They've banned the herb Damiana and wild lettuce. Oh, they're just all over things there in Springfield. Idiots.
Well, like I say, this Northbrook Democrat sounded like a Republican. So
right.
I mean, you know, Illinois Democrats, most of them are pretty good moderate Republicans of a few decades ago.
Well, that same thing here in Rhode Island. They're saying this was led by a Democrat and an Independent, and they've limited cost of living adjustments for 19 years. You know, and that's just absurd. So,
okay. Well, so what he's suggesting is that the COLA, cost of living adjustment, would be the lesser of 3% or half of the CPI. So, if the cost, consumer product index, is higher than a certain amount, then it's half of that. So it's a guarantee of the deterioration of your spending power. So
less than half.
So as if there was another inflation, which isn't on the horizon, and it's kind of crazy that everybody's so worried about it, the inflation monster. But it's an awful thing, and Christina Radoliak praises it, and that's a real woman Republican, not a. What do they call it? Dinos? Democrat in name
Rhinos?
Only. No, Rhino is the Republican in name only.
Yeah,
Dino is Democrat in name only, like this woman from Northbrook.
The only inflation that we have.
Deference to finishing a thought here, please. Go ahead.
Finishing a thought? There is one there.
How about if we do some underwriting announcement?
Yeah,
here?
That's a good thing.
Hour
How about mention the phone number?
Yeah, we are in the middle of our pledge drive, and you can give us a call at 217-359-9338. We are in our spring pledge drive, so we appreciate it. You can keep programs like Illinois World Labor Hour on the air, and we'd appreciate a phone call. But I did want to mention that this hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings right now on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, you can give them a call at 217-469-6111. And also, this hour of programming is brought to you by the listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of Maintenance Way. The Brotherhood of Maintenance Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that we enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And also, this hour is supported in part by the listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And Bill's here.
Yeah, and I'd like to thank Paul for kind of hanging out there and adding a little insight. And
filling in there a little bit for us.
I was just teasing him there a little bit.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah.
But with a name like Vedroliak, he was talking about her as a Republican. That was a big Democrat name.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially up around Chicago. Ed Vedroliak, I can't remember what all he did, but he was all over Chicago politics.
Yeah, was he talking about her?
I thought he was a Democrat. I don't know.
Yeah, I thought he was mentioning her as a Democrat. But
conversant, probably on state.
Ed Vedroliak didn't have a sex change operation. It's Christine.
No, what I'm saying family name.
Well, it's not Vedroliak.
So. Well, what was it? That's what it sounded like you said. Some woman named Vedroliak. Vedroliak, what?
I can't remember her name now because I had aphasia, but I did have it earlier. It wasn't Vedroliak, but let's not be petty. Let's call 359-9338.
All right. And I got another news story here that we'll go into here real quick about a trial that just was going on this week, a labor fight between Hostess Brands and Teamsters. And this Hostess, the maker of well-known products like Twinkies and Wonder Bread, wants bankruptcy court approval to cancel its labor contracts with several unions, most notably the Teamsters. If successful in eliminating the contracts, a strike could well ensue that threatens to kill off the company and eliminate as many as 15,000 union jobs. Hostess has been spoiling for this fight for months, according to court documents and comments by union leaders. In January, it filed a Chapter 11 petition in federal court and immediately sought to invoke the notorious Section 1113 provision of the bankruptcy code, which would allow Hostess to unilaterally cancel its collective bargaining agreements. Soon after the filing, it was revealed that Hostess had anticipated a labor fight 6 months earlier by unilaterally ceasing to make any more cash contributions to union pension plans. Here's another instance where the employer, the state, or the corporation or whatnot, just quit making pension contributions here. After some delays and fitful negotiations with its unions, the Section 1113 trial opened April 17th in the federal bankruptcy court in White Plains, New York, and is expected to last 2 or 3 days, according to the Hostess spokesman. There is little indication of when the judge, Robert Drain, will issue his ruling, or how damaging it may be to the unions, said a spokeswoman for the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers and Grain Millers Union, the BCTGM, another labor organization with a lot at risk in the trial. Spokeswoman Corina Christensen said the Bakers Union, which represents more than 5,000 Hostess production workers at 36 bakeries spread out across the country, is not making any comments about the case until the situation becomes clearer. The Teamsters, by contrast, have been making a lot of public comments about the case. The union set up a special Hostess page on its website, where it has issued a steady stream of statements attacking Hostess officials and demanding a fair negotiation of contract changes free from judicial coercion. It also reported on a vote by some 7,500 Teamster members at Hostess authorizing a strike against the company. And I had a little bit of update here. They said that U.S. bankruptcy judge Robert Drain approved the company's first request to extend its period of exclusivity at a hearing Tuesday in White Plains, New York, over the objections of the official creditors committee in the case and the unions. Hostess will now have through August 8th to file a plan and through October 7th to solicit votes on the plan. So this trial is going on up in White Plains, New York, and sounds like Hostess wants to declare bankruptcy and just put these union workers out of work and has quit funding the pension fund 6 months ago. So, Bill, you got anything over there?
Oh, well, what I'm doing right now is at least attempting to import pictures from Thursday's rally in March so I can upload them to the Labor Hour.
Oh, Facebook page. Yeah. We got a few pictures up there already. And I know you were there taking pictures and stuff. It was good to see you. There was quite a good group of people out there.
Well, you know, man, made me really think about something. You know, that hotel we went to, it was a big deal several years ago when it was built. I believe that was probably, 2006, around 2005, 2006, and of it being built non-union.
Right.
Okay, and what generally happens in these situations, you can only have like three pickets or something in general, at least at per entrance to the job site with the and I remember at that time, during that time, there was one, maybe more kind of community people got together and did like a noon hour sort of lunchtime marches on that job site.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking here, you know, what we have is basically some guy who, yeah, okay, he's a jerk and he did this bad thing for workers in Indiana. That is true, and he's here to speak, and, you know, it's good for us to express our displeasure at him for doing that in Indiana. Don't you think, like, when they were getting ready to build that hotel, or what, when they got started on it, why didn't the two people that were mainly involved in organizing this were in the building trades? Why didn't these building trades people organize something along these lines to protest that and try? I think that could have, you know, with a few other things that I don't know if they did or not, I think could have switched it where that job would have been union.
I do remember driving by there back when it was being built and seeing the scab rat out there. You know,
the
blow-up rat. So there was some protests, like you say, but they were small in comparison to the other day.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's something really, you know, put together. Maybe not as big, maybe not, you know, because there were a lot of people from out of town at that one, you know.
On Thursday?
Yeah. But I mean, it's not a local thing. It's more of a state wide situation, you know, dealing with there. But, you know, then what you do is you get, now I wonder if they tried this. Another idea. Yeah, you go around to all the sympathetic organizations, you know, and talk to them and at least on a local level get them to pledge never to use that hotel, you know, to boycott that hotel and suggest that all their members boycott it.
Sure.
And yeah, pass the word on. I don't know if they tried that or not. You know, you don't hear about these things.
No, you don't.
I didn't see it happening that I know of. Maybe I don't pay enough attention to the local news. You know, I didn't see, like, the leader of the NAACP on the local level coming out and saying that, oh, the building trades have come and told me about this, and, you know.
You're right. It starts with grassroots action.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, it's a Hilton hotel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, right there, and Paris Hilton was available as a target then.
Yeah.
And I didn't hear anything happening on that, you know. And that's what I'm leading to now is, yeah, this could have gone on to a national level, even an international level. Hilton is an international, you know, corporation. They got hotels all over the world.
Right.
You know, there's so many things that could have been done. Go to local officials and say, hey, you know, drag your feet on these permits. You know, that's kind of underhanded there, but I think it's something that could be done. You know, if you cultivate relationships with people.
Yeah, it helps. I mean, I've reported once or twice on, I think it's the Hyatt chain with Pritzker's family owned, and, you know, they've had problems with the service employees at all of their hotels, Chicago, Hawaii, you know, and there's been protests out in front of many of these hotels here going on for a couple of years.
And I tell you what, man, there's plenty of businesses, hotels, of course. I don't think there's any union hotels in this town. But most of them are built union.
Yeah.
And you can say if you can't even get one built union, you're a long way from organizing the employees, because that's showing you they got an attitude, man. Because there's reasons these things are built union. It's because basically it's usually the easiest and best and probably cheapest way to go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know? You know, the company that built that hotel was from Decatur. They had to have everybody come over here from Decatur.
Really?
Yeah, and I was really amazed that there was a contractor like that out of Decatur, which is supposed, you know, has been traditionally hardcore union town.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe they tried all these things and I just don't know about it. But those are the things I would have thought of, but, you know, but I've been spending a lot of time over the last 15 or more years, you know, reading about these types of situations, what people do in them, you know, the idea of the corporate campaign that was devised or at least widely pushed by the sort of controversial Ray Rogers, who is a consultant, I guess, at this point for unions. I don't know. I haven't heard anything of him for a long time, but it's the corporate campaign, you know.
Yeah.
Organize people against the corporation, you know, not just trying to organize the workers.
Yeah, yeah. How about if we go to a little bit of Workers Independent News here? We'll take Friday's edition, and we'll be back just shortly.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Four unions are suing the state of Michigan in federal court, challenging the constitutionality of a law that essentially defunds the unions by outlawing payroll deduction of dues. The Michigan Education Association, the Michigan American Federation of Teachers chapter, AFSCME, and SEIU Local 517M assert that the law is in part retaliation for the recall of a GOP state lawmaker. Howard Gordon is the staff attorney for SEIU Local 517M.
Our claim is that it undermines our First Amendment rights and the 14th Amendment rights to equal protection.
A similar federal lawsuit brought by Wisconsin unions resulted in the court finding it unconstitutional to ban the payroll deduction of union dues, but that decision may be appealed. Gordon says all workers in Michigan have a stake in the outcome of this case because their political free speech rights are at stake.
Working people from anywhere should be concerned about this because this is a stifling of a voice guaranteed under our constitutional rights.
While average worker pay in the U.S. is about $34,000 a year, with wage increases just barely keeping up with inflation, CEOs are paid an average $12.9 million a year, and in 2 years they saw raises totaling 37%. The AFL-CIO makes this information available on its redesigned searchable online database, Executive Pay Watch. SEIU workers protesting continuing demands from the city of San Francisco for labor concessions are fed up with the cuts. The workers say they've already given millions of dollars in cuts, but the demands for more concessions keep coming. SEIU hospital worker Terry Armstrong.
We out here expressing ourselves about cuts and everything that the city and all these rich people is trying to take away from us. Poor people are trying to make it, trying to feed our family.
Inez Banks is an SEIU healthcare worker.
We need to shut the city down.
Yeah.
We need to all get together. All the unions need to get together and get tired of this crap and shut it down. And let them know we are not playing. We are not trying to make the billionaires trillionaires. Yeah. Which we're trying to keep food on our table, keep a roof over our head, and take care of our children.
The worker comments were from California's Labor Video Project. Public workers in San Jose, California have won a court challenge of a City of San Jose ballot initiative aimed at cutting public worker pensions. An appellate court in San Jose ruled that the city's ballot language is partisan and prejudicial and must be changed before being considered by voters. The court also sided with the plaintiff public worker unions, striking language that said pensions need to be modified to make sure that essential city services are preserved. This newscast made possible in part thanks to underwriting from the OPEIU, Office and Professional Employees International Union. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
And we're back. And I got another news story here from labor reporter Mike Elk. And In These Times, the website, says Bartlett Grained was fined $400,000 for 13 safety violations, but it will appeal and will likely avoid criminal prosecution. According to the Department of Labor, grain dust is nearly nine times as explosive as coal dust and often leads to massive explosions. Over the last 35 years, there have been more than 500 explosions caused by grain dust in the U.S. grain handling facilities, resulting in the deaths of more than 180 people. On October 29, 2011, an explosion rocked the Bartlett Grain Elevator in Atchison, Kansas, resulting in the deaths of six workers. Last week, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, cited Bartlett Grain Company for 5 willful and 8 serious safety violations of OSHA workplace safety laws. Among the violations, OSHA found that Bartlett Grain willfully allowed dangerous amounts of grain dust to accumulate. The federal agency, part of the Department of Labor, also found that Bartlett would suck up that grain dust using a compressed air system without first shutting down electrical devices that could cause ignition. It also found that Bartlett Grain was using electrical equipment inappropriate for the work environment. In a citation unrelated to the cause of the explosion, OSHA also found that Bartlett willfully failed to provide safety equipment to workers to prevent them from being drowned in silos of grain. The lack of proper safety equipment provided to workers unclogging grain silos, a common safety violation, led to 2 teenagers being trapped and suffocated to death while working in a corn silo in Mount Carroll, Illinois in 2010. In addition, OSHA cited a contractor employed by Bartlett, Kansas Grain Inspection Services, for 1 willful violation for not providing proper fall protection for workers working on top of rail cars. The deaths of these six workers could have been prevented had the grain elevator's operator addressed hazards that are well known in this industry. That's a quote from Secretary of Labor Hilda L. Solis. And she said also in a statement, Bartlett Grain's disregard for the law led to a catastrophic accident and heartbreaking tragedy for the workers who were injured or killed, their families, and the agricultural community. And the company denies that safety violations caused the fatal explosion in October. So anyway, I'm going to remind you once again that we are in the middle of our WEFT Spring Pledge Drive, and you can give us a call here at 359-9338, or you can go online to our website at weft.org. You can catch us streaming there, and also click on the Donate button and help us. Or many of you have probably received a letter in the mail. You can return your letter. Just send that back into WEFT P.O. Box 1223, Champaign, Illinois, 61824. And as David Johnson frequently says on this program, and as we will all attest, you're not going to hear labor news and things like this on corporate radio, commercial radio around this area or other
not even areas. The satellites.
Yeah.
You'll have to poke around all over the internet, you know, to find. There are other labor radio shows in distant locations.
Right.
There's a radio talk show broadcast in somewhere in Ohio that I see on the internet occasionally on mm-hmm. Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple other shows. You can go to Radio for All.
Right.
There's not that much the specific labor content, though, there except for Building Bridges
right.
out of WBAY, a half-hour program.
Out of New York City there.
Yeah, and its format is they basically have one guest or a topic with maybe a couple of guests or something and interview them. And there's a man and a woman interviewer. I think they're, mm-hmm. at least one of them's a lawyer.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there was Worker Independent News from the folks up there in Madison, Wisconsin, put that together on a daily basis. It's a short 3-minute segment. They don't really have a half hour program or an hour program, but
yeah, you know. And they occasionally I know Tom Hartman runs that, but the weird thing is, and I don't know, I never think to, if there's any of you that are Tom Hartman listeners that are into his message board and all that stuff. You know, tell him that they do 5 of them a week. You know, they do the same one. I guess they get the one on Monday, and they just do it all week.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
It's always the same one every day. I wish he would stop that. But, you know, that's another thing, too, folks. There's no commercial impetus for programs like the public affairs on WEFT as there is for conservative programming of all sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, see, what will happen is, of course, you know, if it's a political economy of the media. And, of course, somebody who is incredibly pro-capitalist is going to get a lot more capitalist sponsors than people who are not specifically pro-capitalist and ranging to specifically anti-capitalist. And this show, is pretty much specifically anti-capitalist.
We're for the worker all the time.
Yeah, and as long as we have our situations where you have capitalists trying to extract value out of workers in one form or another, you're going to have class conflict and so on and so forth. I mean, I don't know. Perhaps perhaps it doesn't matter what system we have if people eventually get mature, but it always seems that capitalism tends to make to drive people towards competitiveness, exploitation of other people, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, yeah. How about if we go to a quick musical break here? I got a song queued up from Levon Helm, who passed away this week. And,
yeah.
You know, famous for many years playing with the band. And this is actually a track from his, I think it was about 2007, he came out with a CD titled Dirt Farmer. So we're going to listen to the title track from that, Levon Helm with the Dirt Farmer.
Poor old dirt farmer, he's lost all his corn. And now where's the money to pay off his loan? He lost all his corn, can't pay off his loan. He lost all his corn. Well, the poor old dirt farmer, he only grows stone.
All right, we're back here on the Illinois World Labor Hour, and want to remind you that we're in the middle of our pledge drive. You can give us a call at area code 217-359-9338. You can go online to our website at weft.org, or you can mail in your donation to WEFT P.O. Box 1223, Champaign, Illinois, 61824. And a couple of public service announcements for you here. Of course, the Boneyard Arts Festival is going on today. And also, as part of the Boneyard Arts Festival, there's the WEFT Wine Tasting Benefit and Boneyard Arts Festival WEFT Art Exhibit that's going on this afternoon from 3 to 6:30 p.m. at the Corkscrew and Bouvon's Wine Bar in Urbana. That's located at 203 North Vine Street in Urbana, with food provided by the Black Dog Smoke and Ale House. I know we're going to have some auction items there. We're going to be having some WEFT artwork with T-shirts, posters, and other items. And Ed Hadley's going to have some of his artwork there. Ed Hadley does a show here titled Incoming Wounded, and that runs from midnight to 4 a.m. on Sunday mornings on WEFT. Also, we can always mention Labor's View TV this Sunday and every Sunday, 4 o'clock on local cable channel 6, hosted by one of the hosts of this show, David Johnson, and Jim Iman, a friend of the show. So, worthwhile things. Also, stay tuned after this show for Occupy the Airwaves. And
That's Ren and Jim Iman at the... also, tune in for Occupy the Airwaves right after this show. At the rally on March Thursday, and he had kind of a comment about, I don't like all these signs and all this talking about middle class.
Yeah, that's one of your favorite topics.
Yeah, well, I told him, I said, the only middle class people here are the union officials.
Yeah, yeah. Jim Iman was there, huh? I didn't see him. I saw a lot of people there, a lot of different colored shirts.
Well, I didn't see you.
I was marching under the bridge. You took our picture.
Well, I tried to, man. My lens is malfunctioning.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's I know it's made in a nice factory in Asia, but it's just petering out on me. The autofocus is going out.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you had a good vantage point up there at the top of the railroad bridge taking pictures of the marchers as they were walking under the viaduct there on Kirby.
Yep.
And quite an impressive showing there. I think the newspaper put the crowd estimate at about 5,000 people. I would say that's probably pretty accurate.
Boy, it did seem like it took quite some time for that crowd to get under the bridge.
Yeah.
I mean, through under the viaduct.
Yeah. And several minutes. There were people there from all around the communities, Peoria, Decatur, Bloomington, Chicago area.
Yeah, there's a lot of laborers from Marion and Marseilles, as we pronounce it in downstate Illinois, rather than Marseilles in France.
I saw a group of people actually came over from Indiana to lend their support to Illinois.
A lot of building trades workers were fairly unemployed at this time of year.
Right.
In these later years, there was... Boy, for a few years there, man, you hardly had any time off. And then, boom, everything went away. All the building went down, and all the interest rates on your debt went up.
Yeah, yeah, yep.
Unless you're going out and buying a $250,000 house, and then you can get, like, a really sweet rate. But, man.
I got a few notes here. This is actually coming from Minnesota AFL-CIO website. And this is just about getting the facts on right-to-work laws and stuff. It says, what is a right-to-work law? It says, despite its misleading name, this type of law does not guarantee anyone a job, and it does not protect anyone against unfair firing. By undermining unions, so-called right-to-work laws would weaken the best job security protection workers have, the union contract. A right-to-work law is a state law that stops employers and employees from negotiating an agreement, also known as a union security clause, that requires all workers who receive the benefits of a collective bargaining agreement to pay their share of the costs of representing them. Right-to-work laws say that unions must represent every eligible employee, whether he or she pays dues or not. In other words, right-to-work laws allow workers to pay nothing and still get all the benefits of union membership. And they ask some important questions about that.
Yeah, I might call that the right-to-hitchhike law. I mean, there's a lot of people.
Get a free ride.
Yeah, I mean, basically, at least for a long time, they're not union workers in general. Got a free ride from union workers. Well, we had a much larger percentage of the workforce. We were a real power and a real threat, and we set the standards for non-union workers.
Right.
You know, and as the unions have fallen away, I think largely due to their own error, the lives of all workers, not just union workers, have gone downhill.
Right.
You know?
What is it now that the private companies' union membership is like 12%, 11.9%?
Oh, it's less than that.
Like?
I think it's down to like 8% or something, and it's around 12% when you include government employees.
Yeah, it's like definitely higher in public sector things. They ask a question here, will right-to-work laws benefit workers? It says, no, workers in states with so-called right-to-work laws have a consistently lower quality of life than in other states. They have lower wages, higher poverty, less access to health care, poorer education for children. This is all according to data from the U.S. Department of Labor and the U.S. Census Bureau. They ask, does it truly earn lower wages? It says, on average, workers in states with right-to-work laws earn $5,538 a year less than workers in states without these laws. And talks about right-to-work states spend less on education. It says right-to-work states spend approximately $2,700 less per pupil on elementary and secondary education than free bargaining states. And they also seem to have states have higher workplace fatality rates. And this, again, is according to data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The rate of workplace deaths is 52.9% higher in states with right-to-work laws. So it says these right-to-work laws don't improve living standards. Union improves living standards. So union members typically earn 28% more per week than non-union workers. Hispanic union members earn 50% more per week. And Hispanic and African Americans earn about 30% more each week if they are union members. So there's a number of reasons why maybe these right-to-work laws aren't really helping workers and employees in these states.
Okay, so here, straight from the Bureau of Labor Statistics via the interwebs.
Mm-hmm.
In 2011, the union membership rate, the percent of wage and salary workers who were members of a union, was 11.8%.
All right.
Essentially unchanged from 11.9% in 2010. The number of workers that is belongs to unions are 14.8 million, which has shown a little movement over the year. Okay, in 1983, the first year for which comparable union data are available, the union membership rate was 20.1%, and there were 17.7 million union workers. Oh, let me see. And public sector workers had a union membership rate of 37%.
Big difference there between private sector and public sector then, yeah.
Yes, yeah. More than five times higher than that of private sector workers, which was at 6.9%.
6.9%, wow.
Workers in education, training, and library occupations had the highest unionization rate at 36.8%. While the lowest rate occurred in sales and related occupations at 3%.
I get in these discussions with some of my family members, and they tell me about how these powerful unions are ruining everything, and I kind of try to cite some of these statistics to them and tell them, how can they be so powerful when there's such a low percentage of people that are actually in unions? They don't really have nearly as much power as these people, the right-wing media, seems to try to portray them. As, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's really interesting that people would have that that perception, though, because of the sort of lack of organized labor content in our culture at this point. If there's the unions, definitely are not represented in this culture anywhere near as powerful as your relatives appear to perceive them.
Yeah, that's the good word there, perceive, because it's their own thinking, you know.
But, of course, about the only place that you do hear about unions is mainly would be on Fox News and the right-wing radio talk shows, where they are constantly using, you know, saying things like that.
Trying to say how much money the unions have given towards election campaigns and stuff like that, disregarding the fact that corporations are now people and corporations are given far more money to some of these election campaigns.
Well, and also then in the mainstream media, the only time you hear anything about unions is when there's a labor dispute. And in the when you get into the national mainstream media, it seems like about the only times they talk about labor disputes are in the auto industry, the airlines, and say the telecommunications industry. Which, if you think about it, those industries have much greater impact on members of media employees, or at least employees who create media, such as reporters and other news people, you know, than, say, a strike at Tate and Lyle in Decatur in the 90s, you know, or a strike at some, even a mining strike. But, you know, those people, they buy cars, they fly on airplanes, and they talk on the telephone.
Right.
Yeah, and just think about it. When you rarely hear news about labor disputes in outside of those three industries.
Right, yeah.
You know, I mean, on the national level in the mainstream media.
Used to hear about them, auto workers and mining industry, coal miners and stuff. But I think the percentage of mine workers in, like, West Virginia that are union members these days is a pittance. Like 3% are union mine workers nowadays.
See, that's one of the things about mountaintop removal is you use a lot of explosives and great big machines and not very many people.
Right.
You know, it takes a lot more people to go down into a small tunnel and dig out coal than it does to have, two or three people out blowing things up with dynamite, and then maybe
ruining the environment.
Yeah, a few operators with big loaders and bulldozers and stuff. And for example, people always talk about urban sprawl, and they don't like it. And it would be much better for people like me if things were built inside of town. Rather than just going, because, I mean, you know, around here, the cornfields and bean fields are pretty flat to begin with. You got a little bit of dirt work, then you can pour concrete right there and build right up. You know, if you want to build a new building in downtown, first you probably have to get rid of an old building.
Yep.
And so on, and it gets much more labor intensive. You would probably build a multi-story building.
Yeah.
So on.
I had a few more facts and background here about right-to-work stuff. It says most of the 23 states that have right-to-work laws adopted them in the 40s and 50s after passage of the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947. Taft-Hartley Act allows states to make right-to-work laws was enacted in response to the belief that the pro-union Wagner Act of 1935 gave unions too much power. The Wagner Act gave and still gives unions the power of exclusive representation, which allows them to act as the voice of all of a company's employees if the union can get more than 50% of the employees to vote for a union. It says the Taft-Hartley Act of 1947 outlawed the closed shop arrangement. Moreover, Section 14B of this act made right-to-work laws legal and gave states the power to pass laws to outlaw both agency and union shops. Nothing in this act shall be construed as authorizing the execution of agreements requiring membership in a labor organization as a condition of employment in any state in which such execution or application is prohibited by state or territorial laws. Therefore, if one lives in a state without right-to-work laws and one employer is unionized as an agency or union shop, one would be required to join the union or at least pay union dues. So more of the history and background about what right-to-work is about. Anyway, we're getting close to the end here. We'll remind you that this is a WEFT Spring Pledge Drive, and you're listening to Illinois World Labor Hour. And you can give us a call, 359-9338. We'd be happy to take your pledge. Or go online to weft.org and send in your letter.
Yes. And by the way, if you are a member of a union, among full-time wage and salary workers, union members had median usual weekly earnings of $938, while those who were not union members had median weekly earnings of $729. So send a little bit of that over $200 difference into WEFT.
There you go. That's what I was reporting earlier in those statistics, too, that unions do help bring you a lot more income there, and they help everybody that's working. It raises the entire standard of living in the state, as it showed. Got more money spent on education for elementary and high school kids in the state, and more money spent just on the well-being of the entire population of the state that you're living in. So any other comments, Bill? I know it was great to see a great turnout of people at that rally on Thursday.
Yeah, it needs to be a much more regular thing. And by the way, something I do want to talk about is earlier on an earlier program, Higher Ground. The host on that program came up on the medical industry in Illinois. Oh yeah, a woman called in who had worked
been
as a nurse.
Right.
Yeah, and had just been fired.
Right.
And and she talked about that. She was from like a union family, more or less.
Right.
And, that is somewhere, because I believe that the medical industry is the second largest industry in Champaign
after the university. Yeah.
And those places are sitting there, totally non-union. Many of the employees are working the swinging 3 day a week
shifts. Yeah.
And so on. And I tell you what, they could be ripe for organization. I don't know, but nobody does it.
Yeah, they're much more active nurses' unions in other states, out in California.
Yeah. And the SEIU, which is the usual union for organizing healthcare workers, has a pretty